Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Hello and welcome to Risky Business. I'm Patrick Gray. This week's show is brought to you by Tenable Network Security, the makers of Nessus, among other things, and you can visit them at tenablesecurity.com. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast if you haven't already. You can find our RSS feed at itradio.com.au/security or go there to sign up for our email notifications. This week, we'll be catching up with HD Moore. Metasploit 3.2 is due out any day now, and HD will walk us through some of the new features and fill us in on license changes that could see Metasploit being used a lot more commonly. He'll also have a chat to us about his latest uninformed.org journal article about IPv6 in pen testing. Of course, the big news over the last week has been the out-of-band release of a patch of a particularly nasty Windows bug. It's an RPC flaw, and I'm sure you've all heard about it. We'll be joined soon by Microsoft Australia's Chief Security Advisor to have a chat about the company's decision to send out email notifications to customers urging them to patch. These notifications were indistinguishable from the sorts of virus-laden emails that used to come around masquerading as Microsoft patch updates. We'll find out what they were thinking in a little bit. And also our good friend Marcus Ranham will join us in this week's sponsor interview. Marcus is, of course, the Chief Security Officer of Tenable Network Security, and we'll get his reaction to Metasploit's license changes and talk a little bit more broadly about exploit tools. Marcus isn't convinced they're particularly relevant in today's security industry. But first, it's time for this week's news with KiwiCon organiser and freelance security guy, Adam Boileau, who joins me on the line from New Zealand. Now, of course, Adam, the big news over the last week has been the super-duper out-of-band RPC bug in Windows, and it's a pretty hairy one.
Yeah, this sounds like it's going to be a good one, this one.
Yeah, I'm still waiting for the network worm. It hasn't quite happened yet, but I've got to say, I actually miss the days of the old network worms, because in the days after Code Red and Nimda and Slammer and Blaster, all anyone ever wanted to talk about was internet security, and, you know, I got to feel like a normal person.
And also, yeah, I think it helped us make, you know, pretty meaningful improvements to security infrastructure as a result. And it also certainly was, you know, good fun, a nice crisis, helps everyone, you know, get together.
Yeah, I don't think we actually need one anymore, but it would be kind of fun, wouldn't it? I mean,
it'd be good fun. I think it'd be great. Bring on the worm.
Yeah, okay. Well, sorry, I must say that the views expressed in this podcast are not those of my sponsors, especially not Microsoft, who is actually a sponsor. But,
Oh, dear. Yeah, that's going to go down well.
Well, I've got to say kudos to Microsoft for actually picking this one up, because it turns out it was being exploited in the wild, and they did pretty well to get on it.
Yeah, I wonder, do we know anything about, you know, who was exploiting it in the wild yet? I haven't seen any specific details yet, but it would be interesting to see whether it's, you know, a national entity or whether it's, you know, underground or exactly what the details turn out to be.
Well, look, I've got an interview coming up with Peter Watson, so we'll be having a look at one aspect of this story, which is that they actually sent out newsletters to all of their customers advising them to download the patch, and it even had links in there. So they basically fished their own customers to get them to do this. But, you know, in my conversations with Peter, he pretty much, you know, I mean, he hinted at the fact that it was some customers who'd seen some pretty weird activity and, you know, they were able to actually pin it down to this RPC bug, which is, you know, really, really similar to an older RPC bug, which is...
Yeah, MSO6040.
Yeah, a little bit embarrassing for the poor folks at Redmond, but I think they've done a fairly reasonable job at responding to this thing, and to get something ready and push it out of band like that, I don't know.
I do wonder how long this has been alive in the wild, though. I mean, that would be interesting to find out.
Well, yeah, you'd think Microsoft would be among the last to find out, wouldn't you?
Well, that's normally how you work it, yeah.
Yeah. But, hey, they found it. There's protection. So if you're running Windows, go patch, and then you don't have to worry about it anymore. Now, look, in this next news item, and it is a news item of sorts. It's just a case of a security company getting some egg on its face. Good old F5. If anyone listening goes to https://downloads03.f5.com, you will find, Adam,
that their SSL certificate expired in, July?
Now, these guys, you know, they do your SSL load balances and stuff. So, I mean, not really much more to report. Everyone makes administrative mistakes. But you got to say, F5, ha-ha.
Well, at least they can spell SSL, right? That's a good start.
Yeah, it is, it is. But you got to admit, that's pretty embarrassing for them, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Although, actually, to be fair, we did the same thing at the first KiwiCon. We let our SSL certificate expire like 3 days before KiwiCon, and everyone thought we got owned, which, yeah, that was embarrassing.
So you're losers too.
Yeah, apparently so, yeah.
Anyway, we won't dwell on it, but we just wanted to rub it in a little bit. If there's anyone from F5...
No dwelling, just rubbing.
Yeah, pretty much. If there's anyone from F5 listening, you know, you douche.
That could be you.
Yeah. So now moving on. And look, there's been a bit of information hit the public about some pretty nasty stuff in some Cisco equipment, but details are a little bit patchy at this time.
Yeah, so this is the report says authentication bypass in VPN access control in Cisco ASA and PIX appliances. Now that to me sounds like a pretty goddamn big deal. Like,
yeah.
I mean, if it's you know, remote, you can bypass auth on the VPN, right? That's a bad thing. And I'm, you know, personally, I find it very frustrating when you look at the you know, vulnerability report from Cisco like this. And I have to say, well, it might be a big deal or it might not. It really depends. And, you know, we don't have any information about the specifics of it.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, when you've got a vendor sort of release of bug information, when they've found the bug themselves, there's not really much motivation for them to come clean and talk about just precisely how awful it is. So, you know, what they've done instead is put out a release with some fairly sketchy detail in it, but certainly enough to make you... you know, shit bricks if you're a Cisco administrator. So, I don't know.
About it, which you might not, because who knows if it's a big deal, right? It's only, you know, people like you who pick up on things that might be big deals and run with them that anyone would ever find out about this. I mean, I don't know. Personally, I find Cisco pretty tough to deal with on this sort of thing. Yeah, their vulnerability information is often pretty fluffy.
Yeah, well, fluffy this is, indeed. I mean, I picked it up via a mate who emailed me a link to secunia.com. It's advisory 32360 on Secunia if anyone wants to go and have a look. But yeah, it's a little bit light on details, and it's the way it's worded, it's really hard to know precisely how bad it is, but it could be an absolute shocker. So
yeah, definitely. I mean, certainly, you know, having someone logging into your VPN without auth, that's a bad thing.
Yes, yes, it's not ideal.
No, definitely not.
Now, look, in this final news item, and this isn't really news because it's kind of old now, it crossed my desk first, I think, early last week, but I didn't, for some reason, run with it in the show. But a couple of researchers with the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology have basically confirmed something that we've always known, which is that wired computer keyboards do spray out a lot of RF that enables you to identify keystroke information, which is very interesting. I mean, I know that many security guys who will not use Bluetooth keyboards because they're worried about, you know, keystrokes being sent off to the van across the street with the dudes with the antennas and stuff. But turns out, even if you're using a wired keyboard, someone with a big enough antenna, close enough, can basically get all your keystrokes.
Yeah, well, I think this kind of Tempest stuff, as you said, has been well known for quite some time, certainly with monitors anyway. But I think, you know, most people kind of think, well, you know, this is sort of, you know, slightly theoretical, at least impractical things to do in the wild. And what I read about this keyboard attack was that made it interesting is that they put a lot of work into going from we can do this in a, you know, in an RF clean room to we can do it in a student lab with 40 machines in it and still pick out one individual machine. And that's quite a big deal. That's a lot of work to go you know, from doable in a very controlled environment to doable in the wild.
Mm-mm. And I think, you know, it doesn't really surprise me. I've got a, you know, okay understanding of RF from my university studies many years ago. And, you know, a keyboard is basically two sets of antennas. Do you know what I mean? It's I mean, if you look at the PCB layout of how these works, it's like a little, I suppose you'd call it a matrix, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just sort of like a matrix and a bunch of, you know, switches, really. So it would be, yeah, I'm not, it doesn't surprise me that this is possible, let's put it that way, but it's certainly going to make people out there, the more paranoid among us are going to be much more paranoid having read about this. And I think it will be an interesting market opportunity for some people to actually market their keyboards as secure, because I don't think it would be tremendously difficult to actually create a keyboard that wouldn't spew out this sort of information.
Yeah, and there's also obviously opportunities for, you know, working with software-defined radio and the other kind of tools you can use these days to carry out this sort of attack, you know, on a hobbyist level or, you know, for university students or, you know, for penetration testers. You know, it might be an opportunity to sell that kind of kit.
On a hobbyist level, does that mean we'll be seeing you driving around the streets of Christchurch with a big antenna sticking out of a sunroof?
That would never happen.
Well, you don't have a sunroof.
that too.
Okay, look, Adam, that's it for the news this week. Thanks a lot for taking some time out.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Of your oh-so-hectic schedule.
Yeah, I'll see you at RoxCon.
Adam Boileau there on the line from New Zealand. It's funny too, you'll actually hear me mention KiwiCon's Capture the Flag competition twice in this week's show, which I didn't quite realise until I was putting it together. I didn't realise how much of a KiwiCon fanboy I'd become. But that will change very shortly. It's out with the KiwiCon references and in with the RuxCon references. Australia's best technical security conference is all set to kick off in the last weekend of November. So go to ruxcon.org.au now to register your intent to attend, and I'll see you all there. Now it's time for a very quick interview now with Microsoft Australia's Peter Watson. He's their chief security advisor. Now, as most listeners would be aware, last week Microsoft issued an out-of-band security update. They detected a zero-day exploit out there in the wild and decided to patch it pronto, which is good, I guess, and they broke their regular release cycle. Now, Microsoft then did something that I personally think was pretty ill-considered. It emailed more or less all of its newsletter subscribers and warned them that they must update their systems immediately with the new patch that they'd just released. The email even included links to download sites and information on the patch and things like that. So, in other words, it was indistinguishable from the sort of virus-infected emails we used to see a few years ago that purported to come from Microsoft. I don't know if you remember those, but they used to say things like, you know, run the attached patch or download it from this link. It's really urgent. And, of course, the patch was, in fact, malware. Now, I became aware of this latest Microsoft newsflash newsletter when a friend of mine, the former IT editor of a major daily newspaper and a fairly big-time geek, actually emailed me a copy of the message because he thought it was a very convincing phishing attempt that I should cover. So it did create confusion out there, even among computer-literate people. So I got Peter on the line and asked him about the mail-out.
The newsletter that we did use is a template newsletter that customers have signed up for. So this wasn't a random newsletter that we just generated and sent out to everybody. These are already established communication mechanisms that we have in place. So we use standard templates of newsletters that we already have in place with our customer database to push that message out.
Don't you worry, though, that perhaps the bad guys could start, you know, ripping off this template and sending it around to people saying, oh, you must immediately install this patch. This is an official Microsoft thing. And, you know, people who are subscribed to your newsletters will have been conditioned into actioning them. Sorry, that's terrible English, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. And look, I think, again, it's always one of those challenges that we do face because we had the unusual circumstances around this one that it was out of band. We had to look at it and say, okay, so what options have we got in terms of how we do communicate out to customers out there? Because a lot of our customers, the reality is, wouldn't be expecting there to be a patch coming out today because they'd be saying, well, hang on, my normal monthly patchy process is going to be occurring next week. So we did have to get the balance between how do we raise that level of awareness? What mechanisms have we got available to us? You know, is it going to cause us challenges or issues, you know, how do we balance that with the potential risk of not communicating to our customers to let them know that was out there? And that was the call we made.
Okay, which department within Microsoft decided that was the best way to tackle this problem? Was it the security team or was it the TechNet guys or the marketing team?
So you're talking to the source. So that was my call. We sat down as a team and said, okay, this is coming out. We have a number of mechanisms in place with things such as, you know, we have premier support agreements for a lot of our enterprise customers. We do have TechNet Flash that a lot of customers are signed up for, more in the IT prototype community. We also have our consumer newsletters. So we went through and said, you know, which ones can we use? Which ones are not appropriate to use? How do we actually make that call?
I reckon any consumer is not using Service Pack 2. I mean, they're pretty much beyond help. It'll take more than an email to save them.
And I think, you know, this is the challenge we've always got, is how do you encourage people to sort of, you know, keep up with the technology, but at the same time, you know, not send them off in the wrong direction?
Yeah, Peter, I've got to ask, did the United States, did Microsoft in the USA take the same step and actually email people on, like, subscribe to Microsoft mailing lists?
So they did. They used different mailing lists and some different communication channels. And again, I know other subsidiaries, so other countries as well, use different mechanisms as well. So again, it was made on a country-by-country basis, looking at what communication channels they had available to them to push that information out.
Okay. I suppose, look, my final question on the whole matter is why did you actually insert links into it? I mean, surely it would have been perhaps a little bit more prudent to just put a message out there saying, look, Microsoft never normally does this. You should never click on links in an email that we're sending out, but we would advise you very strongly to go to your Microsoft websites, load system update and be aware that there is a patch out there. You can access that through the usual channels. Why did you actually put those links in there just to create that? I mean, it has created some confusion, Peter. I've had a few people comment on it.
Yeah, look, I think, you know, in hindsight, if I got to do this again, I'd definitely take on board some of the comments that you raised, Patrick, because I think, you know, when we sort of sat back and looked at it ourselves, we sort of thought, could we have done that better? So I think, you know, it's one of these learning exercises that definitely next time, if we have to do one of these, and, you know, the reality is this is now the second out of band that we've had to do in the last 3 years. Is there going to be another one? Hopefully it's not going to be for, you know, another 18 months, 2 years' time. Again, I think we'll need to assess, you know, how do we do those communications and do them more effectively.
It's hard to calmly and soberly think of a communication strategy when you're running around with your hair on fire, flapping your arms around going, oh, my God, there's ODAI exploit code out there.
well, luckily, I wasn't running around with my hair on fire. But you're right, you know. As I said, it's in hindsight, if we had to do this again, you know, tomorrow, will we do it the same way? I don't think so. And I think as you've pulled out, we've now sort of stepped back and looked at it and said, okay, that's one of the lessons learned we need to think about in terms of, you know, putting links in the email. How can we structure that better in the future?
All right, well, Peter Watson, thank you very much for giving up some of your no doubt hectic schedule to speak to Risky Business.
Not a problem, Patrick. Thanks for your time.
Peter Watson from Microsoft there. And as a matter of disclosure, I should reiterate that there is a commercial relationship between this podcast and Microsoft. They sponsor every fourth episode. Now, on to this week's major feature interview now, which is a chat with HD Moore. HD works for Breaking Point Systems in the USA and is also the creator of the Metasploit Framework, a very handy tool if exploiting vulnerable systems is your business. Well, Metasploit 3.2 is coming out and there's some big changes in the works. For starters, the licensing is being shaken up big time. HD is basically giving Metasploit away so it can be forked and incorporated into all sorts of new projects. And then there's all the new features that he'll be talking about today. Now, in addition to all of that, you'll hear us have a chat about IPv6. HD wrote a really cool paper that talks about all the fun you can have with IPv6, and it's up now on uninformed.org. And I definitely recommend that you check it out, especially, well, look, if you're listening to this podcast, chances are you're going to find this paper useful. It's titled Exploiting Tomorrow's Internet Today, Penetration Testing with IPv6. And the gist of it is that a lot of people don't really realize that on their LANs, all of their systems are running dual stack, and that creates some pretty hairy problems, also in the data center. Anyway, in addition to talking about all things Metasploit, you'll hear us talk about this IPv6 stuff. And the reason I mention it now is I want listeners to really consider the ramifications of what HD has to say when it comes to data center deployments. I started off by asking HD why he's made the decision to release Metasploit under what's called the BSD 3 clause license, and what that 3 clause license actually is.
The original version of the BSD license from Berkeley had 4 clauses. The 4th clause says that if you use our software, you have to attribute us. You have to include something in your software that indicates you got your software from us, and it has to be a big advertising clause. After about 15 years of that license being widely used, people start to say, hey, we really don't like this clause. There's no reason to have it there. It kind of goes against the grain of the license, so that clause started getting pulled out. So when you say 3-clause BSD license, you're really just meaning the most open, most free version of the BSD license.
So you're more or less giving Metasploit away.
Yep, it's as close as you can get to public domain without actually putting in the public domain.
So why did you decide to give your baby away and to let it go off into the big bad world?
When we first started working on Metasploit 3, there's three core developers. We decided that Metasploit 2 was getting some commercial abuse. We saw some folks trying to resell it and kind of do things with it that we didn't really agree with. And we decided, you know, let's at least lock down the license for a little while to make sure that we can get it off the ground, that people start using our software, and that there aren't like 50 forks of our software after you put the first version out. It really is just a bias time to kind of establish the market, get people to be comfortable with our software and realize that we plan on maintaining it long term. So for the 3.0 version, we put under this commercial EULA that said, you know, basically you can use our software for free, but you can't sell it, you can't redistribute it, you can't modify it, you can't fork it. And if you give us any patches, we have the right to use them and relicense them in the future.
Hmm.
So over the last few years, SpoonM and Scape have both gone on to other things and don't contribute to the framework anymore. So I'm really the only copyright holder of the entire Metasploit framework that's actively involved in development. It's unfair to the folks who are contributing code these days because they're giving me code that they basically don't have the license to use themselves. So if they submit a patch to Metasploit, they can't actually distribute the modified version of Metasploit. They can only distribute the non-modified version with all of our restrictions on it. So since we have kind of a new core developer team, it really wasn't fair to put this restrictive license on the code that they're writing. So the idea was we'd open it up under the BSD license. Anybody contributing to the code would have the ability to do exactly what we do with the code ourselves.
Yeah. So you can have Frank's version of Metasploit, Bob's version of Metasploit.
Yeah, but there's only one good version of Metasploit. Even if other folks decide to fork it and sell it and do different things with it, the value of Metasploit isn't that it's just a big software pack. It's the fact that we update it all the time, that we're always working on new things, we're always integrating new stuff. So it's really the community that drives the value behind the Metasploit project, not just our software and our code. And that's really what the license is supposed to make clear, is that we believe that our project is good enough because there are people behind it, not because of just the software that we've already written.
Mm-mm-mm. So would you anticipate that there's going to be some enterprising bunch of dudes out there who's going to basically slap a pretty interface in it, put it in a shiny box with lights that goes bing, and then sell it for, you know, $50,000?
It's already happening, and we've already seen kind of the sharks starting to circle, but we're not worried about it.
Mm-hmm.
With the 2.x version, there's actually a lot of companies who already borrowed code from it or sold it or included it with different demo products, and, you know, it bugs a little bit that they don't contribute back, but the thing is, we're not getting these contributions anyways. It's not really going to bug us much if we're not getting them now, because we weren't getting them before.
But it just must make you grate your teeth to see people profiting off your sort of, I don't know, it's not philanthropic work, but it's, you know, it's your public domain sort of freely given away work.
That's true. I think one reason why waiting a couple of years from the original version of 3.0 to make it open really helps us, because if you're a consumer and you're buying a security product and you buy this product and it has a big list of exploits in it, you look at those exploits and you realize, hey, this is really Metasploit 3.0 or 3.1 or a tool I've already used before.
Mm.
It'll be pretty obvious to the folks who are selling the software and the folks buying it what's going on. So by having established our user base before opening up the license, we think it really is going to cut back on the amount of hoodwinking the vendors are going to do with selling our software to people who can get it for free.
Yep. Okay, fair enough. Well, it will be interesting to see what happens and to see whether or not there's an explosion of, well, hopefully there'll be a whole bunch of extra research and development done using Metasploit as the basis. I mean, you know, when we've seen a lot of interesting products come out for Snort over the years, for example, and, you know, Marty Roach found SourceFire and, you know, have all sorts of proprietary stuff that uses that engine. So who knows what's going to happen, right?
Yeah, actually, since we've announced the license change about 2 weeks ago, we've seen probably 15 new projects start up that all want to contribute and all want to do new things. There's one project that just came up recently where a guy wants to build an entire video game around Metasploit, an educational game based on, you know, breaking the machines and getting points and doing things like that, that I think is really cool, and he's willing to basically stand up and run the thing. And it's only because we have it under the license that he's willing to do it. Same goes for a lot of other projects that are just starting to come out of the woodwork, and BSD is just much more friendly to folks who may want to use their code at work later on. So for folks who are doing, you know, pen testing or security development or security research, having it under the BSD license means they can actually contribute to the framework and really work on these new interesting projects.
Yeah, no. I mean, a video game wouldn't have been my first obvious use for Metasploit. But hey, you know, whatever you like to do on your weekend.
it seems more like a capture the flag style game, but
done
with real
right.
exploits and real targets. So it's kind of an entire virtual environment where you can go break into machines and test things and use things. And the goal is to really get people up to speed on how security and exploits work. And then put a fancy interface around it. So I think
and
it's a
make
cool
it
idea.
Fun. Yeah, I mean, you know, I was at KiwiCon in New Zealand, and they did their sort of token-based capture the flag. It was awesome, and it got people who were like if you tried to get them to hack anything on a weekend, you know, a lot of these dudes, they're like, nah, man, come on, you know, it's my day off. And you put them down in front of a, you know, you make it a competitive environment, and all of a sudden everyone's basically doing these pen tests on this local network and really fired up about it. So, yeah, bring on that game.
Great.
Now, Metasploit 3.2 is coming out, and you've got a fairly long list of new features that's plonking out into that release. Can you explain what they are?
Sure. The last release we put out, the last official release, was in January 2008. That was 3.1. We had about 450 modules. 265 of those were exploits. 150,000 lines of Ruby code. And we had some support for things like, you know, kernel payloads and Wi-Fi stuff and some slightly different types of features that we started to expand out into. With 3.2, we not only do we have the big license change, we've got a brand new development team behind it. We're now up to 577 modules. We've got over 300 exploits in the tree. The code base has doubled. So we're now at 300,000 lines of Ruby, and it really consolidates like the last 10 months of work. So we include all the DNS spoofing stuff, the exploits we had for Dan Kaminsky's bug, Byakugan stuff from Pusscat, the Windebug extensions for running exploits, Druid's context map, payload encoding stuff. Just basically it's a huge wrap-up release of all the things we've been working on for the last 10 months or so, kind of being consolidated and made stable and things like that. We've got stuff like raw packet libraries for doing any kind of like raw network, you know, man-in-the-middle stuff or denial of service. We're kind of ramping up all of our back-end libraries and APIs to do that much better.
And you wrapped in a bunch of that stuff that we spoke about with the, you just said it, the man-in-the-middle stuff with the cookie theft
all
that, you know.
Yeah, the man-in-the-middle stuff has actually been actually expanded a bit. Not only do we have a new way to do the actual Wi-Fi side of it using Airbase and a bunch of patches to it, we also have a whole new slew of man-in-the-middle modules for it. We have a browser auto-exploiter that you can tie into it. So no matter what vulnerabilities your browser may have, it'll find them and exploit them as part of it. So it steals your data, it steals your credentials, it installs backdoors, and it owns your browser at the same time.
Nice. I remember the last time you came on the show was to talk about that wireless stuff that you'd been working on, like an extension to Karma and stuff, the Evil E.
And I'm still working on, I've got a little mini laptop project where I integrate this stuff as my test platform, but I won't cover that right now. And of course, one of the big features is the full IPv6 support that we added to Metasploit 3.2.
That was my next question. I know that IPv6 support is coming in Metasploit 3.2, but it's actually kind of a big deal, isn't it? It's not just a matter of just adding an extra capability to, you know, interact with IPv6 services that no one uses. This is stuff that is going to make Metasploit much more useful in IPv4 situations, isn't it?
That's right. To implement v6, we had to not only change our entire socket library, all of our networking routines, all the stuff that touches the network basically to use v6 and support v6. We had to modify a lot of exploits. We had to modify all of our payloads. We've got new Windows stagers that can transport over pure IPv6. So you can actually run exploits against Windows machine using just the v6 stack. Where that gets interesting is that when you start looking at IPv6 and how it's being deployed, there's a big disconnect right now. It's being deployed a lot on the backbones and a lot of new operating system support IPv6 on the local network, but very few people actually route traffic through IPv6. So like June 30, 2008 was the IPv6 deadline for the DoD to have IPv6 on the backbone. That was met. Supposedly you can actually run IPv6 on the backbone of the DoD right now for the U.S. government networks.
Well, I do all the time.
And right now, I mean, if you buy a copy of Vista, the newest version of OS X, or, you know, install Ubuntu, or any modern OS distribution, it comes with IPv6 default.
Mm.
So even if you're not using IPv6, your interfaces on your local network support IPv6, and they actually have an IPv6 address that it auto-configures.
Everybody's dual stack, whether they like it or not, pretty much.
Right. And if you're running, you know, XP or an older version of Linux or a BSD stack, it's really easy to enable it, even if you don't have it enabled now. And, of course, you know, you talk about IPv6, and what it comes down to is no one actually cares about it. There's just no market demand for it. It's a checkbox feature. There's really few endpoints that actually use IPv6 right now on the Internet.
Well, that makes it a lot of fun for you, doesn't it? Because people who write things like intrusion prevention systems aren't really looking for IPv6 badness. So you can actually slip a lot of stuff through, can't
you? Exactly. I mean, not only are IPS systems kind of not looking at IPv6 traffic right now, but most local Windows firewalls and Linux firewalls don't actually inspect IPv6 traffic. So you have an IP tables rule on a Linux firewall saying, you know, drop all traffic. Well, that's not going to apply if you have an IPv6 address, which is now the default on many Linux distributions. So if you're firewalling off all your traffic via IPv4 net tables, you have to explicitly add an IPv6 rule to filter it out. Otherwise, anybody on the local network can contact your machine's IPv6 address and get straight into whatever service you're trying to protect.
So hang on. That's cool. Right, I didn't know that. So anyone running sort of IP tables on IPv4 on some Linux box, they've got a zillion services that are listening. They're all blocked by this wonderful IP tables firewall. But if they've got an IPv6 address as well, you can still access those same services over IPv6?
And if you have the IPv6 module loaded, you have an IPv6 address, even if you didn't configure it. And unless you specifically add V6 tables and have NetFilter 6 enabled, there's no way to block that with your normal IP tables rules. So even setting your default policies and stuff doesn't really matter if you're not using NetFilter 6.
Mm. Now, I imagine, too, that this would be something that would be a lot of fun in the data center for, you know, poning the guy in the rack next to yours, if that makes sense.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, the neat thing about this is because all these modern operating systems have V6 enabled on the local network, and you've got now, you know, Metasploit supports it, other tools support it for breaking into these machines. If you, for example, you know, break the root password on, say, a Debian machine, or you log in with one of the cracked keys, and you log in via an IPv6 address, well, when the admin comes in and they look at their logs, they're going to see someone logging in from an IPv6 address, and they'll have no freaking idea what you're doing or who that came from. Or, you know, it just doesn't make any sense to people when they see, oh, last login from FE80:00:00:00:00. It's like, what the hell is that?
Exactly. Yeah.
Did an alien attack my machine?
Now, you've, aliens. It's always the aliens. Have you, just ask Gary McKinnon. you've written a paper about this for uninformed.org, haven't you?
Yeah, the latest version of the Uninformed Journal came out. I wrote a pretty in-depth paper on IPv6, how you can test it, how it works, how to use the tools. So if you want more information, you can always go look at the Uninformed Journal article for that.
So if anyone's after some light reading...
It's kind of dry, but it's interesting. There's a couple... One of the gems in that paper was that in IPv4, if you send a package to the broadcast IP address in the local network to a UDP service, nothing replies. So you have a DNS server in the local network, and you send something to, you know, 192.168.0.255, well, everything's going to ignore that. However, with IPv6, if you listen on the INI address, the 0/0 address, kind of the default service listing address, and you're a UDP server, you will respond to IPv6 request to the broadcast address by default.
Yeah, now this I found hilarious. I mean, this was I've read your paper, and, you know, the thing that I took, I mean, you know, using my peanut-sized brain to actually read through it and try to comprehend it, the thing that I found hilarious about this is, you know, the namespace is, you know, the IPv6 space is so huge that, you know, scanning it is just not feasible. But you can just send out a couple of broadcast packets and everyone goes, hey, here I am. It just sounds, that's a lot of fun.
One of the cool hacks of it is, let's say you've got a DNS server in the local network and it has an IPv6 stack. Like, for example, on my work network, we have an Ubuntu server, it runs a local version of Bind. We never configured IPv6, it just happens to have an IP anyways. If you send a DNS lookup to the broadcast address, it replies back. So in your resolve configuration where you set up your name server, you can actually put the broadcast address into your name server field, and it'll work just fine. It'll query whatever local name server handles it first.
I wonder if that's one of those sort of things where people are going to wind up doing that. Not really. Everyone uses DHCP these days to configure name servers. But you can imagine, right, that in Bizarro World, people would actually start using those broadcast addresses just because it's easier, and you'd wind up going into a LAN to figure out what was going on it, and all you'd be seeing is bloody broadcast DNS requests and responses.
If that was the intended result, or that's just how things worked out, or if this is going to get fixed in the future?
Yeah. It doesn't sound too great, really. What do you think will happen with that? I mean, do you think a lot of this stuff will disappear from IPv6 as we go on?
Well, hopefully we'll deploy IPv6 before I die, but I doubt it. The way things are going now, I mean, maybe China, maybe Japan, maybe a couple of countries in Asia will deploy IPv6, but they'll most likely be stuck with IPv4 for another 10 years.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, you know, I've always watched what's happened with IPv6, of course, because, you know, in the media, it's like when there's nothing else going on, it's like, what do we do? Okay, let's do a story about IPv6. And come on, it's just one of those issues that's always going to be there. God, heaven forfend if they actually roll it out. We won't have that fallback anymore. But, you know, you look at China and it makes perfect sense for China to have actually rolled it out because, you know, you really do have a bit of segregation in the internet along language boundaries. And there's so many people in China who would be using IPv6 to access Chinese language only services who, yeah, I mean, they could use IPv4 dual stack to go outside. But, you know, just inside China, it kind of makes sense. You know what I mean?
Yeah, we're actually seeing some of that right now just with the DNS services. Like right now, if you go to your address bar and you type in some domain, blah, 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 .com, it makes sense. But if you're trying to type in a Chinese language domain, unless it's like one of the Englishified ones, like 123.com or, Zhenhao.com, you really have to have, UTF-8 input, your DNS arrest of support, international domain names. There's a lot of things that just have to be in place before you can even access these names. So by having a language that isn't easily represented by, basically 8-bit ASCII, the internet's already starting to be segregated along those lines.
Yeah, well, serves them right, because I'm a little bit annoyed at the Chinese, because every now and then one of their major search engines will accidentally misclassify one of my podcast files as a Cantonese pop song, and I get about half of China trying to download it.
But do you have fans that dance along with it? Is there a Patrick Gray fan club for your Japanese pop songs? Or?
No, but I've got this great mental image of in my head of some... student or something on his way to university in Beijing being very excited and trying to find that new file he downloaded off the internet on his iPod, and then hearing us talking about IPv6.
So you need to change your jingle, so your jingle starts off with a Cantonese pop song, and then you can, really live it up.
Then the fraud is complete. Okay, HD Moore, thanks a lot for your time, as always.
Great talk to you again, Patrick.
HD Moore on the line from Austin, Texas there. Next up, we're speaking to Marcus Ranham, the Chief Security Officer for this week's sponsor, Tenable Network Security. Our sponsors get to come onto the show to have a natter about current events. That's how risky business makes its money, and it's what sponsors pay for. But we're particularly lucky this week to be speaking to Marcus about the license changes to Metasploit, and more broadly about exploitation tools and their role in the security world. I started off by asking Marcus what he thinks will come of licensing changes to Metasploit.
I don't think it's going to change too much. I mean, the folks who are using tools like that for legitimate purposes probably have most of the capabilities that they already need in order to make the point that they're trying to make. And it's just going to make I'm not sure who it's going to make happy, but I think that the availability of it isn't going to really make that big of a difference.
So you wouldn't expect that a lot of commercial players will just sort of jump on the Metasploit bandwagon and start churning out their own products based on the underlying technology?
I would be surprised if they do. I mean, it's my opinion that actually being able to exploit systems as part of a pen test is a fairly limited market. I mean, the customers that appeals to are the ones who are doing a penetration test and are not willing to believe their pen tester that vulnerabilities have been found. And so it's a niche of a niche is really what I'm saying. I've spoken out before against such technologies, and I think a lot of people have missed the point of what I was trying to say. It's not that I'm saying that, hacking tools are bad. It's really that if an organization is doing a pen test, and the only way that they're going to believe that their systems need to be fixed is if somebody holds them down and rubs their face in it. That's already so dysfunctional that, I have to seriously doubt whether that organization is actually capable of doing anything meaningful about security in the first place.
But I suppose the tools like this are useful in other stages of pen test. I mean, for example, if you're just going after one of the easier systems, I guess, to use it as a launching pad for attacks on other more critical services within an enterprise, I mean, it's going to come in handy then, right?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's a tool for a pen test where what you're actually doing is you have to demonstrate that you can actually compromise the systems. And again, that's something that I just find that really dysfunctional. If my doctor comes to me and says, you're about to suffer a liver failure, stop drinking so much Jack Daniels, my response is not, oh yeah, I want to see that. I'm going to listen to him. That's what I brought the expert in for in the first place. And so if I've got an expert who does an audit assessment of my systems and says, this machine is vulnerable to this, 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 and this, it's kind of strange to imagine that somebody would go, I don't believe you. You have to show me.
But surely, surely there would be, systems in between you and the target that,
Sure. But see, in that sort of situation, back when I used to do pen tests, and here we're talking 1994. Back in those days, the way I would do it is I would ask for network maps. And, you know, why on earth would you go into, you know, analyzing a client's network blind?
That's always struck me as a little bit weird when people do those sort of pen tests, because I think really what's the point? And I hear some pen testers boasting about having found these really easy sort of vulnerabilities that enabled them to get into some sort of system. And they're like, oh man, it was the easiest pen test ever. And it's like, well, what did you actually do? You just found some absolutely, you know, incredibly obvious way in, and you're saying, oh, that's great, my job's done. Your job's not done.
You just took a bunch of your customers' money to show them how stupid they are.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so I guess I'm starting to see your point here. I mean, that the few times when I've heard pen testers say that to me, it's just been, you know, quite stunning. They think that the test is over as soon as they pop root on the Oracle box, you know?
Dan Gear used to talk about this, and the whole problem with pen testing from a business standpoint is that the reward structure for pen tests is completely whacked. The pen tester wins if he makes the customer lose, and the pen tester loses if the customer wins. So the pen tester is going to be rewarded for doing any ridiculous, crazy thing that they can possibly do so that they can claim that they won. And that's how you get things like the, you know, here's your USB, here's your free USB dongle, ha, 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 got you kind of routines. You know, and then the pen testers who, you know, they just find one little hole and they go there, my job is done. Right. And so, you know, back when I used to do this kind of thing, I'd go to the client and the first thing I would do as part of the kickoff meeting is I would ask for all of their network maps, all the topology information they had. And, you know, it's pretty quick that you can look and you can, oh, you know, this is a bastion host between two networks. There's an isolated network with a bastion host here. And then you just start asking what that's running. And maybe you do a software assessment of the configuration of that host, but you don't need to sit there and go, well, I'm going to break into that host because if I break into that, I get into your SCADA network, right? You can say that in the conference room. You can say, well, you look at this network map and it's really clear that this machine has to be extremely penetration resistant, because if it's penetrated, it's a gateway between, you know, your regular networks and your SCADA networks, and that machine has to be locked down really tightly. What did you do to lock it down? And then they should be able to tell you.
I've got to ask though, Marcus, like if you had gone in and done that whole step of locking everything down, would you think that it would be useful to have someone externally doing some sort of blind test afterwards, just to make sure?
No, not a blind test. A blind test. I mean, again, the way that I always try to get my clients to see it is, you know, you're supposed to have a plan for how your network is secured. You should be able to make a strong argument that the security of your network flows from some kind of a security design. And so what we're doing is we're doing a design review. And then after we do a design review, if the design looks good, if the design's stupid, right? If you've got your mission critical network connected to a public internet and there's no firewall, there's no need to do a pen test. I can go, this is bad design. So you do a design review, you see if the design looks good. And then once you've done the design review, if the design looks good, then you do an implementation check, and you can go and you can see if the implementation actually matches the design. And that's valuable to the customers. There were a couple times of actually a really funny one that happened to me was when we first set up WhiteHouse.gov. It was on this little when it moved down to the executive office building, it was on this little mezzanine network down in the Office of Science and Technology Policies network. And I just thought it would be interesting to do a ping sweep of that network from the inside, and I found an NT4 workstation that wasn't on any of the maps. Very interesting. Someone had plugged it in so they could play on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's an example where the design says that there's not supposed to be a machine there, and the ping sweep says that there's a machine there. There's no need to hack into that machine. You have a failure.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And that's the reason I think, you know, these things like Metasploit and Core Impact and all this, I mean, they play very well to the amateurs. They're crowd pleasers. But they're crowd pleasers, unfortunately, that really appeal to the people who don't understand security.
Look, I would agree with that to an extent. I mean, I was at KiwiCon a couple of weeks ago, and I saw a lot of people using things like Core Impact in the Capture the Flag, and I just thought, oh, come on, you know, like that's hardly sporting. You know, how much does that cost for a license? And you're sitting there and using it against a Capture the Flag competition. There's been this real fascination over the last 5 or 6 years with, you know, sort of memory bugs and things, you know, remotely exploitable memory bugs where you can just throw a few dodgy packets at a system and it executes shell code and blah, blah, blah. But it seems like we're going back to more old school hackery, where it's around configuration problems, you know, bad ASP and PHP and those sort of things. It is getting interesting again. Brett Moore did a fascinating talk on taking over Citrix systems, and it was so old school. Like, you basically had to modify this config file and then throw it against this other box, and it'd send you, you know, to give you anonymous access to calc.exe, and then you could go in and manipulate the help interface so you could get cmd.exe and then find a local and get in that way. And, you know, Core Impact is not going to do that for you.
Right. Well, but the other thing is, you know, these tools like Core Impact and Metasploit and whatnot, what they are is they're expert systems. They take somebody else's expertise and they encode it into an interface that allows someone who has no expertise at all to click go and launch a successful attack. Now, if the idea of something like a capture the flag contest is to show your skills, if you show up in a capture the flag contest and you're clicking go on a power tool that you bought from someplace else, yeah, what you've really shown is that you actually have no skills whatsoever. You know how to click go.
There you go, guys. I mean, Marcus Random just told you, you got nothing.
Yeah, sorry. Don't screw up my credit history, please. But you know, my 75-year-old musicologist mother could click go on a copy of Core Impact. Does that make her an elite hacker?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I don't know your grandma, man, so hard to say. But so you don't think that things like Metasploit, even things like Nessus, which you guys make, you don't think those sort of things can be handy for doing some of the grunt work?
Well, absolutely they're handy for doing the grunt work, but you have to understand what the tool does. If I was doing a pen test today, of course I would use Nessus because, you know, what am I going to do, sit there and type ping in over 10,000 times? It's great to have a tool that automates that logic for you, but you have to understand the underlying logic. You know, I would look at the critical juncture points on the network, and, you know, I would expect that my Nessus scan found no vulnerabilities on those machines. But you also need to know enough about what it's doing underneath to be able to interpret the results and see if they make sense. You know, one of the jokes that I played back in, gosh, I guess this was 97, you know, I had this little thing I wrote called Back Officer Friendly, which was a Unix emulation of a Back Orifice server. So it looked like your machine was infected with Back Orifice. And I used to run that on Unix workstations, and these auditors who didn't know what they were doing would come in and they would run a scan and they'd go, oh my God, you know, your son's server is infected with Back Orifice. And we would just beat the crap out of them for being idiots.
That is pretty nice. What was that? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So what? All they'd see is an open... Oh, it actually emulated the service as well. You didn't just put a listener there.
It emulated the service well enough that the Back Orifice client, if you told it to do a scan, it would go, oh, this machine has Back Orifice on it, which is all they did. I mean, all they would do is get the BO client and just run it. You know, because if you know anything and you've done an Nmap of a machine and it's identified as a Solaris server, and then you connect to the Back Orifice listener on it and it shows you C colon, if you know anything about computers, you know that someone's having fun with you.
Yeah, C colon on a Solaris box, that'd be different.
Yeah, it's just like you were saying about the old school hacker. The person who actually understands the underlying rules of the system is always the person who is going to have a greater level of mastery than the person who simply understands a set of rote techniques. And, you know, and again, this is something I've ranted about any number of times, which is that the kind of the trade in exploits is foolish because it's information that has such a short shelf life.
Mm.
That, you know, you're not really teaching anybody anything. You're teaching them, oh, look, this bug that I know about this month worked against your system this week. What you really want to do is teach people the underlying principles of how do you do asymmetric attacks. And, you know, there's different categories of asymmetric attacks, you know, denial of service being one of them, yada, yada, yada. Mm. You know, you need to understand the basic principles.
Marcus Random, thanks again for taking some time out to speak to Risky Business.
Always a pleasure. Dense bubbles swell in the sky, the star people and pure energy. The essence of all that you now are, and soon shall return to beings of light. Transcend thy spoken riddles, mean nothing in a kingdom of plants.
Marcus Random on the line there from the USA. And that's it for this week's edition of Risky Business. Big thanks to our sponsor, Tenable Network Security, and thanks to all of this week's guests. This week's Sound Foundation track is The Chattering by Daya Dover, and you can buy it at soundfoundation.com.au as a non-DRM encumbered MP3. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. Hi, yeah, yeah. Hi, yeah. Hi, yeah, yeah. Refresh this memory at times is like a sip, planning for gold in ancient Greek bats. Sifting through dreams on a cliff's ledge in your mind's eye. Then sparkle swells in the sky. Oh, yeah.
voices chattering. Do you hear voices chattering? 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 Hey, everyone, let's speak soon. Isn't that amazing?